it is statistically significant. It is, in my mind, one of the silver bullets for Discover. I've got problems here. And so I started seeing the power of this. And then I started med-picking my own deals. And I was like, holy God. And when I actually took MedPick, operationalized it myself, used it to find gaps in my deals, and then run plays and take action, I literally made almost $1 million that year. It was my highest W-2 year ever. I ended up getting promoted. And from that point on, I have taught every human I've possibly met this, because it is that life-changing. That's the story. Well, anybody wants to fight me on this, fight me right here on this.
In the comment.
All right.
Hello and welcome back to Masters of Medic. Today I have an absolute master with me, Mr. David Weiss. How are you doing, sir?
Andy, thanks for having me on, man. I'm doing awesome. I'm pumped for this conversation.
Yeah, me too. We've been talking for a long time. I think one of the things we both love about our medic ecosystem is just that there's so many folks who are really passionate about what we do, selling mostly, but also the medic part of it. So getting a chance to get your expertise, I've been a massive, massive fan of your view of the world, sales, and all things you say about medic for a while. So to get you on the show is great. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, David?
Yeah, Andy, feelings mutual, sir. So a little bit about me. I'm a 20-year sales leader. I like to feel like I'm, you know, still an operator, still a high-level practitioner. Today, I am the chief revenue officer for a company called The Sales Collective. So we bill ourselves as a sales transformation company. So the whole thought is we don't want to put you in a box when it comes to how you need to solve revenue challenges. Mm-hmm. We like to look at the ecosystem. We like to look at your entire way of going to market and generating revenue, and then figure out, hey, look, do you need more people? Better people? Do you need to assess and coach and develop the people you have? Is it a technology problem where we can create scale with your business with tech? Is it a process problem we need to stand up, document, and implement processes? Do we need to onboard? Do we need to train? Do we need to help leaders be better leaders? Do we need to insert, you know, chief or fractional chief revenue officers to guide everything? Like, where is the challenge? And let's work together to solve it. And that's really the approach to the business. And that's the business I lead. And it's a lot of fun because it's what I love doing and helping companies with. So it's cool when you get to merge the side hustle and the main hustle together and actually, you know, do what you love doing. So,
yeah, totally relate to that. You know, we're in a funny kind of way similar in that, you know, we both salespeople turn sales leaders, and now we get to talk sales whilst being salespeople and sales leaders. It's like the trifecta of what we want to be doing. So that's super cool. So the show is Masters of Medic. So we should definitely start there. How did you find out about Medic, and maybe give us a little bit of insight into your journey?
My origin story.
I like that. The medic origin.
I was dipped in a vat of radioactive and you know, fluid, and then I pulled out and it was like, boom. It's funny. So I want to go back. Like, this is almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I was working ADP. Mm-hmm. I was global sales executive, kind of like a strat account executive for them. It was the year before I became one of their leaders in the RPO BPO business for them. Mm-hmm. And there was a new leader. There was an org change. And I normally hate org changes because they almost never go well. And I almost always get stuck with a leader who's just, you know, I don't know how bad I want to disparage people, but just a terrible human normally. So I was really dreading it. And so this guy came in, and to my surprise, it was one of the greatest leaders I've ever worked for to this day. He's still a friend of mine. His name is Gregory Donovan. And Gregory, him and I still talk every week. And Gregory taught me MedPick. Now, anybody who also knows me, if you try and tell David, me, I'm not doing good enough, I have a problem with that. Because I normally work really, really, really hard. And I normally spend a lot of time mastering whatever craft I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. So when someone says you can do better, I'm normally like, you can piss off. Because I've already worked that, like, I can't work more hours than I do. But Gregory came in and introduced me to MedPIC. And I pushed back. I was like, I don't need it. I already have a process. I already have a methodology. I already have an approach. And it's already successful. I'm already one of the top sellers in the business. I'm good. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, I think you could really benefit from this. And I'm like, I'm good. He's like, can I just teach it to you? And I'm like, sure. So he taught it to me. And I was like, I'm good. But on every single deal review call, every single pipeline call, he would just simply ask me, hey, David, what's the business case for this deal and what metrics drive it? Hey, David, who's the economic buyer? Are we with them? And he would just MedPIC me. And right. He would do it in such a nice way. It was just simply like, let's point out where you've got a problem in this deal. And then mm-hmm. let's talk about how you can go close that gap to win more. Right. And eventually I was like, man, these are great questions. And ooh, I've got problems here. And so I started seeing the power of this. And then I started MedPICing my own deals. And I was like, holy God. And when I actually took MedPIC, operationalized it myself, used it to find gaps in my deals, and then run plays and take action, I literally made almost $1 million that year. It was my highest W-2 year ever. I ended up getting promoted. And from that point on, I have taught every human I've possibly met this because it is that life-changing. And that's wow. The story.
Fast question back to you. What would you think you would have done that year without MedPIC?
Easily half as much.
Half.
Easily. Half. And that's me being like, still puffing my chest out a little bit. Like, yeah, it would have been.
Yeah. This resonates with me. I'm sure it resonates with loads of people watching and listening who've kind of been on a similar sort of journey themselves. What the thing that's interesting to me is that a lot of what you were talking about there was about using it to spot the gaps, you know, kind of like see opportunities to increase your chances of winning. And how most people classically use MedPIC is like that. You know, it's kind of to sort of qualify where they are in the opportunity and the opportunity, you know, strengths and weaknesses and that kind of thing. But the kind of the way I think about how you were talking about that is it's like, you're still the same salesperson, right? Underneath, you were still, so you were using it as this framework to identify gaps, let's say. And then you were applying what you already said right at the top, you know, I'm good. Like I know what I'm doing. I'm very well versed at this. And so really, you know, in your story and in so many people's story, all it was doing was kind of acting like, and we like to use this sort of term of it being like your co-pilot. You were Maverick in this example, in this story, right? You've got like MedPIC as Goose right next to you saying, hey, like asking you those questions. Obviously, you know, the ejector seat in your year worked and Goose didn't like launch himself into that, but you know, so that's where that I love that analogy so much, but it always breaks because of, you know, Goose. So anyway, but yeah, so it's interesting, always fascinates me that.
Yeah, man. And look, I've rarely met a seller, especially top performer seller that doesn't get myopic, that doesn't look at their deal and think, I'm running a good sales process.
Right.
I know how to sell. I've rarely met someone that's like, that's really good at a craft. That's like, I need help. Mm-hmm. I'm failing. Like, but MedPIC did that for me. MedPIC mm-hmm. created a way that I could remove blinders mm-hmm. and myopathy in my own deals and scientifically, objectively, show me where I may have something I'm not seeing. Right. And that to me is the power and the beauty and behind it is it gives you that lens that in common language and common view So you can ask for help of people that also know this thing, and they can see it and help you in the way that they know you need because of it. That without it, man, I don't ever think I would have been as successful as I am. And that's why I love it so much.
The interesting thing about your story, which is slightly different to mine, was that you, as you said, you were a top performer before MedPig. I wasn't. Like, I had been a top performer relative to being like a big fish in a small pond in like startups and that kind of that world of before I kind of a sort of evolved my experience and career to kind of step up to the top level, like places. I don't say top level being Oracle, but like there's like a, it's almost like you're into a new world when you're an enterprise selling at places like Oracle. And I remember like arriving there and, you know, had success behind me, but I'm looking around at the people I got to work with and I was like, whoa, like these people just, they just seem to be on another level to what I am. I never for a moment thought I wouldn't get there, but I just thought that it was going to be time that would get me there. And I thought that like, I just knew, like the way I describe it is it's like they were playing sales in easy mode, if it was a computer game, and I was playing it in hard mode, right? But the small-minded person would go, oh, they've got all the good accounts. They've got the good leads. I knew that wasn't the case, right? And so I just knew I had to get better, but I didn't know what it was. And when I actually learned MedPig, that was what did it for me. Like, and so it unlocked my full potential is how I like to say it, but it didn't happen like overnight. Like I learned MedPig and I was like, okay, this makes total sense. There's not a bit I didn't understand, not a bit I didn't think would benefit me, but I had to like lean in, and it probably took a month before it really kind of, I won't say clicked, but a month before I really got it in its full context, like where I started to really understand how the decision criteria fitted, the decision process fitted, the real difference between a coach and a champion, those types of things. But I say it's probably like 3 months before it felt natural. And then maybe 6 months before it became like second nature, where I was just part of my muscle memory. How was it for you? Like, do you remember like how you sort of lent into it?
Yeah, it was quick for me. Because what's interesting is like MedPig didn't teach me necessarily anything new about sales. Mm-hmm. What it taught me is how to look at the process I was running and figure out where I would lose, where my risk was, where I had missed a step, where I didn't go deep enough. And then it forced me to level up in those areas, in those deals. Because it can be hard to do all the things all the time in every deal. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say this for you sellers listening, but if you want to win, you kind of have to. Because if you're not running a great process and somebody else is, you have risk. And that's what, again, to me is the beauty and the elegance and the power is every, and this is how I operationalize it. I literally still have the whiteboard in my office, even though I'm not running cycles, it's still there.
Yeah.
And every morning I would look at my whiteboard, I would look at a deal and I'd MedPig it in my mind and I'd ask myself questions. Do I know this? Where am I at with that? And I would color code them. I'd be like red, yellow, green. I'm red here. Today, David, you need to take, this is my inner monologue. You need to take action to move this red to yellow or this yellow to green in this area. And you can do that by starting to do this, this, and this. And it would literally be my system of action. And so once I learned that, like that moved really fast for me. And I think we talked about like everything I do it at a high urgency because of my fear of mortality. But I picked it up quick. Because to me, it was simple, but it was also powered in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how you kind of, how you're talking about this is what's naturally coming across is that you are focused on spotting what we would call the gaps in your opportunity. And I think one of the things I'd love to get your view on that I think our industry gets wrong, and this is very much for me a cultural issue, is that this concept that if a salesperson has a gap with their opportunity, with their deal, it's representative of them not doing a good job with the opportunity. Mm-hmm. Whereas my view of the world, our view of the world would be, if there's a salesperson who has identified a gap with their opportunity, they've done their job, they've done a good job, right? Because mm-hmm. selling isn't a linear process where if you put in at the front end, you put in a good prospect, like a qualified prospect who needs your product, has pain that you can solve, who has unlimited budget, and then you've got the best product in the world for them, and then you are the best salesperson. Those are like the perfect ingredients, right? It's not going to be a guaranteed deal, right? Even in the everything's like 10 out of 10 in terms of how you'd want it. It's not a guaranteed deal because there's a whole world of things that can happen. People believe like economical things, like scandals, like there's like a gazillion things that can happen in the perfect scenario that you still need to be on your game, even the best scenario, to spot those gaps, because only once you find those gaps can you fix them. And so I do think there's two parts to this. There's the finding the gaps, which is where MedPick obviously really helps very, very, very strong in terms of like seeing how well, you know, how strong your value proposition is, how strong your value is in the eyes of the customer, how well engaged you are with the stakeholders, how well do you understand the customer's process? Like, it's brilliant at that. And so that's part one. Part two, which is that cultural bit that I talked about, which is if I'm a salesperson in a sales team and I have, you know, probably similar to your manager that you mentioned that you work with that taught you about MedPick, this great vibe, this great culture where I feel like respected, I feel like they understand my value, then I'm going to be much more likely to stick my hand up and say, you know, hey boss, got this great opportunity right now with ABC. Here's where we're at, but I haven't like this, I just can't find a champion, or I can't find a way to the economic buyer, or this is their decision criteria. I can't seem to influence it away. And I think I, you know, whatever the problem is, whatever the gap is, that's me doing the best possible job I could possibly be doing in that scenario, because there's probably more people in the business that can come together and do reviews and team sessions to help me there. And so I think that's as much as the actual framework helping people spot those gaps, you've got to get the culture right. What do you think?
Yeah, man. So I've got a philosophy that a lot of people will probably disagree with. and I've got if I have a way of looking at sales that I don't want to call it like seeing past the matrix. Mm-hmm. But I almost relate it to that. And this is the concept. The concept is a stageless sales process.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe in stages.
Okay.
I believe if I'm looking at my theory of sales, there's really two components. There's circular motion, and there's no stages. It is things that have happened. So now certain things do happen in certain stages, but they don't have to. Okay. And even though they happened here, it doesn't mean you won't circular motion back to them over mm-hmm. time, like a discovery motion, like a solution presentation or alignment mm-hmm. motion, like a business mm-hmm. case creation and expansion motion. Those things you learn. And then as you go through learning, you go back and then you continue. And so I'm there's not a lot of people who believe what I believe. I hear very few people talking about it, if any, but I don't believe sales should be stage driven. I believe in the stageless sales process. In the stageless sales process, it's not about the stage you're in. It's about what you've accomplished in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that view has allowed me to layer MedPick on top of it mm-hmm. and say, where are the gaps? What have I not done yet? How do I figure that out? And because mm-hmm. there are no stages, it's not like I have to do this at this point and this point. We're not there yet or any of that crap. It's mm-hmm. here's the problem. What am I going to go do to solve it so I can, in a way, check a box or cross it off or do one of the needed things that I know I need to do to win? And by approaching it that way, it's a little bit of like infinite game theory in a way, but it's like, you know, the job is to keep the ball in the air and find a way through the motion to accomplish the thing. And it's just a different way of looking at it. But I feel like at some point, the sales world is going to adopt this and transfer to this. And the only reason it hasn't is because of Salesforce and CRMs that force you to go through these stages. And that's how they freaking set things up. And I think that's the limiting factor here, is the way we track deals and the way deals actually work are not aligned. And that is a problem.
Yeah, because I see what you're saying there. And there's like a really strong angle, I think, on this, would underpin your thoughts, which is like, customers don't buy to our sales process, right? We've got like whatever your sales process is different from the customer. Like, we don't go in to meet the customer in the first meeting, going, by the way, we're in stage one right now, and before we can get to stage two, I need to check, you know, do these things with you and all that kind of stuff. Like, customers, just, you know, they have their own way of doing stuff, which is like, you know, which is the beauty of actually why I think MedPick has stood the test of time, because it's literally reverse engineered from how customers buy. And so, yeah, in that world, I totally see where you're coming from. The thing I'll throw back to you, because I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think there needs to be a I agree that there's not like discovery, for example. Like, I don't think discovery is a stage, right? That's complete nonsense to class discovery as a stage. Even if you take away all of the layers that make great salespeople great, and you just look at it from like a perspective of meeting one, I meet one person, and then is discovery supposed to be done then? I've done a great job. I've got a second meeting. Now all of a sudden there's three people in this meeting. Am I not going to do discovery with them? Like, that's like table stakes, right? So even in that regard, but also the fact that, you know, by meeting two, meeting three, they've probably met the competition. If the competition's done a good job, they should have taken them off the course that we're on at least a little bit. They should at least influence their thinking towards their way of thinking a little bit. We need one. If we don't discover that, we're going to carry on going this way, thinking they're with us, and we'll turn around, like, where did they go? And they're like, so, you know, that's an example there. And I think the same goes, you know, now we live in this world of, you know, customer life cycles, not one-time sales, which has been the case for like two decades now. But people still like to kind of point out, you know, that the sales process is still very much set up for that start and end, and in relationship, which we know is not the case.
Yep. Yeah. I can't wait until Salesforce or somebody, you know, figures this out and creates this, because it's the CRM that drives the behavior. Because you have the sales leader that drives the CRM management, which then drives the behavior. And I've never met a sales leader in my entire career that's like, oh, new stakeholders entered the deal. I'm glad you moved it back to stage one. Why'd the deal move back? Why are we going backwards? We've been in that stage for too long. My in stage metrics are getting impacted because of this. We need to, you know, accelerate the movement by stage. The accountability, how leaders look at it, all of these things. And it doesn't mean that, you know, if you do some discovery and then you're moving to a solution presentation and more people get inserted, that you don't do the solution presentation, or that you try and do discovery in the solution presentation.
Yeah.
It means before that meeting, you reach out to those stakeholders and have one-on-one conversations with them. So when they get to here, you're now all on the same page and can now demo or solution present to the needs of everybody. Like, we need to be a little bit more creative with how we approach things, because it can all get done. You just need to think about that.
Yeah. I remember once I took a role as an EMEA leader, and I came into the role and the CRO told me that there's a 5-to-1 pipeline coverage, so, you know, meaning 20% conversion rate, I guess. And that's what I needed to hit my target. And so let's say just for argument's sake, $1 million for the quarter. And I came in and we had 8 million in pipeline to close the quarter. And I was like, whoa. I was thinking, this, I've heard about these jobs. You know, this is the one. This is finally, after, you know, having it difficult for so long, this is the time where I'm actually going to just land on my feet. And in about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I figured out that it was like the land of the living pipeline, right? You know, it was all just dead. And what was happening was that basically it was getting towards the end of the quarter, and like the AEs were like lifting up the hypothetical like quarterly rug and just sweeping it into the next quarter. Just get it, dead pipeline in there. And so the first thing we did was implement MedPick. The second thing we did was like just like lock it down. It's like if you don't have like the things you'd expect, like what I would class as a qualified opportunity, where we have qualified with the customer that there's true value that we can provide to them, and they are engaged on the basis of evaluating our solution to uncover whether that value is enough to make it worthwhile them investing in it. And we're engaged with stakeholders who are helping us to be able to do our job, and we understand what the process ahead of us looks like. If there's not that, it's not pipeline. Let's like get it out. Like, unless it's like obviously early pipeline, we haven't had a chance to qualify that, but this is stuff beyond that, right? And so what happened was the pipeline went from like this 8 million figure, for argument's sake, down to, let's say, 3 million. And all of a sudden, all the dashboards have lit up red for the EMEA region because they now don't have enough pipeline to cover the quarter in the company's eyes. And I'll be honest with you, Dave, like for a good month of that quarter, I thought I was going to get fired. It's like, that's what they were looking at. It's the same thing as what you're talking about, the sales process. Cause like if that's the lens they're looking at, like all of it. And what actually happened was we overachieved, not by a massive amount that quarter, but we overachieved. We did over our target. And of course now everyone's like, oh, you only need 3x pipeline coverage. And then, so it was like, one of those things where you're using the wrong inputs for basing your behaviors. And I think that's what you're talking about, the sales process.
Yep. Yeah. That's a lot of it, man. It's what is actually happening in the deal? What have you accomplished? What have you left to accomplish? Like, so I've created like a checklist for myself. That's literally about 90 questions, about 12 questions per letter of MedPick. Mm-hmm. And, each of those per letter has 12 questions. And once I answer those 12 questions, for all intents and purposes, it's everything that could happen inside that letter. And once I've gotten all of those answered, I am highly confident in that letter and I'm good. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I look from a stageless sales process perspective. It's very, and you know, as we all know, and you know, MedPick is not linear, and you don't go in order. And it's very simply like I look at that list of 90 questions, and I simply ask myself those questions. And if it's a yes, cool, I'm good there. And then you know, if it's a no, it's like, okay, how do I turn that to a yes? Really that simple. And I've like a 95-98% plus close rate. That if I get all those to yes, I'm winning that deal for sure.
Active God or something that's stopping it, like something, right. Someone's like, yeah, something's happened. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. You said something there, Medic isn't linear, and it reminded me of a topic that we like to talk about all the different myths of Medic, which there are many. And I'd love just to, what's your favorite Medic myth? What's the one that, like, I guess favorite might be the wrong word, but what's the one where you hear it, you're like, oh no, not that one again?
There's probably two. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think MedPick is Medic, MedPick, MedPlus, whatever your version, is a sales process. That's what kind of the idea of linearity. I've had people be like, look, I'm not showing up to a first call and being like, what's your business case for change? I was like, this is outbound sales. They don't even know. I'm like, dude, like, it's not what we're saying. We're saying at some point in the deal, you need to build a business case for change and use metrics to drive it. Like, so like the other one is, well, you know, MedPick's like, bam, I show up to the call and I just ask it all. I'm like, no, not that either. No.
Nope.
I remember getting in a fight with one of the big time influencers who loves to talk about gaps at one point, because there was a lot of correlation. That he was making between MedPick and Bant. And I'm like, you need to stop. Like you don't understand the thing you're arguing, and you're arguing it wrong. Like, please, for your sake, I want you to look good. Stop.
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? Like the correlation I've seen, and I've yet to be proven wrong on this, is that anyone that is publicly criticizing Medic, I've not seen anyone yet where they don't meet this two criteria. Number one is they've never used Medic. So you never like see, oh, like it's like, cause I get, like you do, I'm sure, get tagged in these posts all the time. You click on it, you think, what's this person saying now? And then you're like, who is this person? You click and you're like, not a Medic company, never worked for a company that has implemented Medic. So that's the first thing they never, ever have. And the second thing they will always have, always is an ulterior motive. They've always got their own methodology, their own like thing, and they kind of see that there's noise about Medic and they try and like pivot off of that to make, but what I think they fail to realize, and you just see this by looking in the comments, and I don't mean any disrespect here, but the people that like, yeah, I agree, like never, again, never seen someone on there. They're like, oh, that's a company I really have heard of. Like that's a company that I've seen is doing things. It's always like, you know, the company that's selling like the software that does something that in a very, very niche market that's so, so far away from best practice that, you know, they, and again, they've never used Medic. And so to your point, I think what they don't realize, and it's a shame because like we're the same, Medic's not a zero sum game. The more people using Medic, the better. If these people, because some of them are sharp thinkers, right? Some of them actually have really, you know, good things to say. They have good views of the world. Just this one bit of like this like little chip on their shoulder about Medic. If they could get their head around like what actually it probably is, then everyone would be better off and they would look good to everyone instead of just looking good to this small subset of people and everyone else that uses Medic that knows it being like, eh, they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. And I love reading the comments there. And I'm often part of many of those where I'm just like flaming, like, no, stop. Like you don't know what you're talking about. The other big one, man, and you probably see this often. MedPick is not there to teach you how to sell.
Right.
You know, I haven't figured out the right, I call MedPick a gap analysis checklist. That's how I look at it. People can look at it however they want. I don't necessarily consider it a sales methodology. Mm-hmm. Sales methodologies in my mind, and maybe I'm splitting hairs or not defining it right. I could be being stupid about this, but to me, a sales methodology is something that teaches you how to sell.
Yep.
So like Challenger is a sales methodology.
Yep.
Consultative selling as it was originally wrote is a sales methodology. Spin selling and the stuff that Rackham teaches is a sales methodology.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of sales methodologies as in, the methodology is the car. This is what I'm going to drive from start to finish to get a deal.
Mm-hmm.
My view, and I honestly think because of this view is why a lot of the sales training companies try and bash MedPick or Medic is because they think we're competing with them and they don't realize that, dude, we're not competition. Like we are very different things. In fact, if you actually learned what we did, you would love us because we're the way your methodology becomes actionable and effective
and integrated.
Because we sit on top of it and we sit on top of it from start to finish, whatever methodology you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
And we ensure no one misses the actionable ways to deploy that methodology.
Yeah.
So I relate it to a blind spot detector. You have your car methodology that you're driving to get to where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have MedPick, which sits on top of it, which is integrated into your car, which while you're on your journey, stops you from crashing into a wall, hitting the person in front of you, backing up into another car. It stops you from making a mistake.
Yes.
It helps you avoid accidents. It de-risks your journey. That's how I look at it. And I think that's a huge myth and for a lot of people, a misconception.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. What I would say is that the way you could describe that is very similar to how I think about it, but I kind of think about it slightly different. And the way I think about it is, one of the things I love most about Medic MedPick is the concept of the common language.
Mm-hmm.
And so what MedPick does beautifully, you heard me say a little bit earlier, is for me, professional selling is three things. It's value, stakeholders, and process. Mm-hmm. What value is it that we provide to the customer? Meaning like what pain do we solve? What value what value is there in solving that pain? How is it that our solution solves that pain in a manner that's like better, different from everyone else? Who cares about that pain? Who cares about the value from solving it being stakeholders? And then like process, like how do we go from this being a spark of interest to being an evaluation, to being a closed deal, to being a renewal, to being everything thereafter? And of course, they all bounce across each other. So when you think about the process, you need to think about the stakeholders as well and all that kind of stuff. But if I just come to you as a salesperson, let's say we're doing a deal review and I just say, okay, David, tell me about the value on this deal. Tell me about the stakeholders. Tell me about the process. It's like too zoomed out. I'm going to be wanting to find out one thing. You probably start talking about another thing. You're probably not wrong to talk about that thing. It's just too far zoomed out. So for me, MedPick zooms in just to the right level so that we can have a very, very cohesive, very, very efficient conversation about value, stakeholder, and process. So if that's the base layer, right, and that's the common language that carries not just across your sales team, but your whole go-to-market team, right? Because your marketing team can benefit from talking about personas the same way as you do stakeholders. The marketing can benefit from talking about metrics the same way you do. If they can start to use metrics and case studies in use cases, then you can use them to kind of urge your customers to share their metrics with you and all that good stuff. So it becomes this common language. And so where I see most people, like 95% of people use Medic, is exactly as you said. It's like this kind of framework that sits there to kind of spot gaps. And therefore, when you spot a gap, you apply the methodology, which is the how, to solve it. And like you said, methodology for me could be discovery methodologies. It could be things like value pyramid, free whys, new business meeting frameworks, all the things you said. How I think that the opportunity is, though, and why I don't mind, why we certainly would say that Medic is more than a qualification framework, how we use it, is because we would say to our customers, similar to what you were saying, yeah, qualification's great, but also here's a methodology that we have built around metrics. So we have like an M1, M2, M3 methodology.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, you've taken it really to some awesome place, especially with the tech you've built around it. Yep.
Yeah. And so the idea there is that we are actually expanding, and all we're doing, because if for those like, you know, we've almost got two people we're fighting against, people like you and I. We've got like the gurus who have never used Medic and they just don't like it because they see it's competitive for all the reasons you said. Then there's like the orthodox Old Testament, like Medic 1C, can't change it, shouldn't change it, shouldn't do anything with it, it's perfect as it is. And so it's like we're fighting on two fronts. So those people, they would say, well, you can't call it methodology, you know, we can't expand it because it's just this. And I would say, well, sure. Like if you're using gap selling as a framework to do discovery, to spot those gaps, then that's very much going to help you find pain and quantify pain. Brilliant. But what if you don't want to use gap selling? Then you can use our metrics framework, right? Mm-hmm. The same thing for all the things all the way through. And so I actually think that the big opportunity is that if your organization has implemented Medic and you're using it well, and your organization strongly understands, you know, how it fits into the opportunity, then the big opportunity for everyone, for all the other methodologies, for anyone, is to actually expand Medic language into everything you do. So it becomes the common language that actually, when you build a value pyramid, it doesn't necessarily talk to all like these new terms. It talks back to Medic terms, pain as being like a related to it, or like where if you talk about the needs, it relates to the decision criteria and those types of things. So we're kind of just expanding it that way. And I think that's a huge opportunity to expand people's existing investment in Medic to bring other things they've invested into the ever as well. So that's kind
yeah,
of-
I completely agree. And everything you just said and the power of that common language is incredible, man. When me and Gregory or any other like person that I've taught this to that knows the framework really well, me and them can look at any deal and in 5-10 minutes tell you all the reasons you'll win, all the reasons you'll lose, exactly what you need to do, the actions you need to take. Like, it is efficient. And that's one of the other things I really like. Again, going back to the fear of mortality, I like being really efficient with time. I really want to make sure that the time I'm spending is good. Like, you and I are we need to look at this the same way so we can make progress on the thing the same way. Because if we're both speaking a different language, like it's going to take way longer to figure out, you know, how to move forward. The power in the common language cannot be emphasized enough here. It's incredible.
Yeah. So another myth that I hear a lot is, and this is kind of relating to a little bit something that you mentioned about that idea of, you know, my favorite one that makes me laugh the most. And I call it favorite because I don't even dislike it when people come up with this, because it's like, wow, could you have done any less research into this before forming a strong opinion, which is that they think, like, similar to what you said, that you have to kind of go through everything in a first meeting. But my favorite flavor of that is when they're like, well, it's MedPick, so I have to start with metrics. So you imagine like get onto Zoom meeting, go, yeah, okay, so Mr. and Mrs. Customer, tell me about your metrics. Like, it's like, no, not that one. But the one where people say, well, MedPick's only for big deals. It's only for big opportunities.
Yeah.
And I get where they're coming from. I totally get it. Cause that's where it's, you know, that's where it's like, it's great. It's brilliant for that. You know, you're going to get, but my answer to this as a myth is exactly why it works so well for big deals is because you should use MedPick relative to the complexity of the opportunity. So if you are selling DocuSign to small businesses, right? To, you know, like a let's say you're selling DocuSign to a law firm that has 10 lawyers, right? Then, you know, you're probably not going to meet the, like, what would it be in a law firm? Like the general partner, like the lead partner or whatever, you know, you're probably not going to meet that person because you might have one call and a demo and then you might close via email or something like that. But it doesn't mean that you should disregard the economic buyer, right? You shouldn't be like, well, I'm not going to meet this person, so I should just disregard them. So in that situation there, I'm doing an extreme, right? But like if that like one call closed deal, the salesperson should still consider the economic buyer from a perspective of, hey, the person I'm talking to, who I'm hoping I can build to be like a mini champion in this one meeting and this maybe two or three emails back and forth, I need to prime them for when they go to the economic buyer to get them to sign this off. Because that's probably going to happen, right? It's probably going to go to somebody who's going to go like, why do we need this? What is this? Like, can't we just send them a raven with a letter on its leg and they sign it with their like quill or something, you know, I don't know. But, and so it's like that for me is like, let's make it relative and let's make sure we still consider, is this person going to be able to act as a champion for us? Have we given them what they need in terms of making it clear what the decision criteria is for this person to go and get the action that we need.
Yeah, man. And I look at it like that. And I also look at it as I don't care what size deal you're selling. Mm-hmm. MedPick is the foundational elements of all sales transactions.
Right.
Forever. And I'll give a really like clear example. Anybody who wants to fight me on this, fight me right here on this.
In the comments.
All right. Now, Let's create a baseline. Like this was fun. So Andy, would you agree that door to door sales, let's say pest control,
yep,
is one of the lowest complexity sales on the planet?
Yes. Yep.
Would you say that it's low dollar, low complexity, fast transaction, and it's B2C?
Yep.
I can't tell you how many people would argue with me. David, you can't use MedPick there. All right, check this out. Guy came to my door the other day to sell me pest control. He's like, hey, out of curiosity, do you have a pest control vendor? Competition. Yes, I do. Would you be open to making a change? Competition versus status quo. Well, it depends. What does yours cost? Metrics. Well, I'm paying this. Well, do they charge you for other fees, other metrics? What's important to you in a pest control vendor? Decision criteria. Ooh, he asked me that question too. If my wife answered the door on this thing in our stakeholder, this thing in our household, she would be a champion. I make the decision pest control because I pay for it. So I'm the economic buyer. He's talking to me. So, you know, yes, I pay. I look for this in a vendor. Cool. What are they not providing you? Ooh. Well, you know what? They weren't, you know, granulating my lawn and they weren't getting further down to my dock. And so I'd love if a vendor could, you know, take care of those areas. Oh, that's a problem. Why is that a problem? Well, I have a 9-year-old and he sometimes steps on anthills and I don't like that. So I have to granulate my own lawn to avoid the ants. Oh, well, we could take care of that service for you. There's a problem. There's an implication of pain. My 9-year-old's getting hurt.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Well, hey, are you under a contract? Oh, paper process. You know what? My contract's up in a couple months. Cool. Well, how are you going to make a decision to make a change? How should I follow up with you? So look, I just got MedPicked and I just showed you how MedPick can be applied. If he didn't ask one of those freaking questions, there would have been a gap in risk in his deal. He wouldn't know what I was paying, so he couldn't compare his. He wouldn't know the service that I was providing. He wouldn't know who made the decision, when the contract was up. I just proved to you MedPick is valuable in door-to-door pest control.
That's brilliant. Brilliant.
It applies everywhere.
It does. It does.
To me, the difference, level of scrutiny. How deep do you need to go with how many people to feel confident you fully de-risked it? You can be it that fast with a low complex, high transaction, door-to-door B2C motion. In a, you know, B2B high complexity motion, it could take you a year to get good at all of the things you need. It's just a level of scrutiny and time.
I love that. That's excellent. That's outstanding. I feel like we're going to need to take what you said there. I, as you were saying it, my brain was like seeing like a cartoon of this guy at your door, like trying to like, you know, and then you've got like the letters like being checked off as he's going through it. Cause I thought that was really, really fun. I like that a lot.
That literally happened. And that was a really fun conversation with me because he just had a conversation with me and at the back, he's a salesperson. So at the back end, I said, can I tell you something? Have you ever heard of MedPIC? And I taught him MedPIC to the guy who knocked on my door.
Doing naturally, right? Just doing it naturally. That's brilliant. You know, there's so many things. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but like I started, my first job in sales was knocking on doors, B2C. And in the UK, it's called double glazing. So that is like the, I know in the US, I think like secondhand car sales is seen as like the lowest rung of sales, but like in the UK, like we've got secondhand car sales, of course, but this is way lower. This is like as low as it gets. And and that was what I did for a while. And there are some things I learned doing that that I still use today that's, you know, and one of the things I loved about that, you know, one of the things that's interesting, just to digress a little bit, one of the things that's interesting is I found it really hard to move from B2C sales to B2B in as much as people wouldn't hire me. People would be like, we love, you've got like this like self-starter or this kind of like they could, you know, all of my stories or like all of my like interview question answers all orientated around knocking on people's doors, like all like kind of what we would call like hustle type approach. People are like, we love that, but you know, just come back when you've got some experience of B2B. And it's like, well, how does that work? That's like a catch 22 if there ever was one. Come back when you've got some experience. You're not going to give me the experience. And so I found it really hard to get in, right? But the thing that I think, there's a few things I think are really, really strong about people that are doing those like high velocity sales engagements. And one of them is it just trains your emotional intelligence like you would not believe. It's like an accelerator because a typical salesperson today, like would probably come out of college, university, and they might go into some sort of customer facing role. Maybe they'll start as an SDR and then they'll go into the field, right? If they're an SDR, they're booking meetings. They might be sitting on a few meetings, but maybe 1, 2, 3 meetings a week, and then they become an AE. And then what have they got? Like if they're a commercial, maybe at most 2 or 3 customer meetings. Like how many sales cycles a month, right? Not many, like on the like grand scheme of things. When you're knocking on doors and you're doing like cycles, full cycle. You're knocking on the door, they're booking your meeting, you're going and selling your product, you're doing the paperwork, you're doing the contract on the day. I think that was such a good experience of just like learning like how to handle objections, how to deliver value, how to read people, all that kind of stuff. So I feel like if I ever interview someone that they come from that background, they're like, they've got like a massive level up in my mind rather than a level down.
Yeah. I have a deep respect for anybody who does door-to-door. Anybody who does door-to-door and knocks on my door, I have a conversation with. I've tried to recruit someone to come work for me at times because it is the hardest thing to sell. Because you are like, just start the starting point of door to door. You are interrupting somebody at home.
Yeah. Massive.
Not at a place of business, even though I work from home. So it's technically both. Like the starting point of that is my first sales job, I was selling, uniforms, and floor mats and shop towels for a company called Aramark. 5-year contracts. If you didn't close it on the first call, your win rates were like 5%. Like needed to 5-year contracts, 1 call close, uniforms, floor mats, shop towels. I cut my teeth there, and you know, 200 calls a week, 16 appointments a week, knocking on 30 doors, submitting 4 to 5 proposals, like high velocity, high action. Immediate close, build value really, really fast, identify pain really, really fast. That's where I cut my teeth and where I learned so much. Like everything else in life has been easier since then. But oddly enough, that was one of the most fun jobs I ever had.
My second job in SaaS, I worked for a startup and I was like their first commercial employee, I guess, like the first non-founder employee. And it was an e-commerce platform for a B2B industry. for a vertical market, I should say, sorry. There's two things about that job that I always reflect on really interestingly. One was there were 5-year contracts for SaaS. 5-year contract. There is no negotiation here. It's a 5-year contract. And the second one is we don't negotiate on price. It's just like, that is the price based on this tier, whatever you're on. And I'd started that job and it was like, that's that. There is no change here. That's it. It's black and white. It's that. And if they didn't want the 5-year contract or they didn't want to pay the price and I couldn't convince them to, it was closed loss. There was no like going backwards and forth. And I used to like, I reflect back on that so much of like how much better, like if you could test this, and I don't know if any company would be brave enough to test this in B2B, but if you could take one of those like really well established, maybe public companies and just say, right, for the next year, we're doing 3-year contracts, right? And no discounts, like net, how much worse / better would they be? I don't know the answer. I don't feel like they'll be worse. I really don't. I feel like if you could get everyone to buy into it, I feel like they'll be better off.
Yep. Yeah, that's a tough gig too. 5 years, 5-year contracts are
5-year contracts
are no joke. That's like that most marriages tell us 5 years.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, it's so funny. And then the funny thing was that one of the founders had been selling up until that point, and he still continued to sell for this company. And I found out like later that he was just writing any kind of contracts he wanted. But what he told me was it's only 5 years, and of course, like he would outperform me as well. Yeah. Like A, because he was like way more experienced than I was. B, because it was his company, he was one of the founders. He was like, but C, I didn't know this at the time, but C, because he was basically discounting. He would do like, sometimes there'll be a use case for them to have two e-commerce platforms, like two stores. And he would like do like, well, if you buy one, I'll give you the other one half price. But then he would tell, then we were only counting because there was no, because every store should have been the same price. There was no like, we weren't measuring sales via ARR. We were measuring sales by units. So he'd be like, I've sold 10 stores this month. How many have you sold? I'd be like, I've sold 5. But really, he had sold 5 as well. He'd just given 5 away for free, or like with short contract. Right. It's like,
and the 5 you sold were infinitely more profitable.
Yeah. But I almost wouldn't mind like reflecting back now about it, because he got like the best from me in that kind of way. But it was just the stick he used to give me. He used to like, oh, you know, I've beaten you again. And it's like, hang on a minute, you're playing with cheat codes. I'm playing like the real game here, right? So
that's shady. But
talking of
him for getting the most out of Andy White.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, talking about people knocking on the door is a fun thing. Someone knocked on my door maybe six weeks ago. And I was like, who is this? So I went out. And it was like a 16-year-old kid, and he was asking if I would take him to prom. He liked my car. He asked me if I'd take him to prom for like his prom. Let me be clear here. Like, I phrased that wrong. He was asking me if I'd drive him to his prom.
No, I got you. My eyes lit up because wow, the confidence and that's a person like that. That's a person that's going places.
Yeah, exactly.
In your car, but sorry, keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I actually, cause it was caught on the Ring doorbell, and, I thought, yeah, let's do this. And so we're making a little like mini video about it. Cause I kind of caught him and I was like, you know, I was asking like, what made you do it? Like I was trying to get across to this like 16-year-old kid that as a trait in life, to see something you want and be brave enough to knock on somebody's door you don't know, could be a complete stranger, was a complete stranger, to get what you want is something that he needs to lean into and just be like that. It doesn't matter if he goes into sales, whatever he does in his life, that's going to set him up really, really well. But
you're going to be a serial killer, or you're going to be like an amazing entrepreneur. And the funny thing is like, there is a very fine line between the two at times. That's like the difference in a slight personality trait is that's not me saying they've actually like studied that. Like there's a very interesting line between people who, do terrible things and also business owners. So, hopefully he channels that for good.
I like that. David, something that I loved from our previous conversation we've had before is we're very aligned on our view of the importance of preparation for engagements with customers and how we sort of see discovery and all those types of things. One of the things that I love that you told me about before, that I was like, oh man, if David is up for sharing this with our audience, this is going to be one of those little gems that we're definitely going to cut and put into its own little soundbite and that kind of thing, which is how you approach first meetings.
Yeah. So there's a, as you know, and I've shared this with you, I've tried to make Medic, MedPic, whatever version you like to use, as actionable as humanly possible. Like, to me, that is the power of it, is finding where you have a problem and taking action. I look at Medic, MedPic as a system to drive action. And so to me, action is taken through the concept of plays. So like, I look at it as like, hey, this is, you know, this is where we are in the game. Here's the play we're going to run to move the chains, advance the ball down the field. Mm-hmm. So I look at, and however you want to look at it, I look at taking action as running, you know, plays like in a game. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've written a book that has 79 plays in it, and it's called The Sales Tactician's Playbook. And I look at it literally like X's and O's, like, you know, playing a game. And there's a couple plays in there that are variations of themselves that both drive discovery, identification of pain and implication of pain, that drive, you know, business case and value realization, and things like that, and solution alignment. And one of them is called the Faces of Discovery play. There's also a Faces of the Problem play that takes what I'm about to share and broadens it to entire teams of stakeholders and end users with specific quotes and their face tied to them that can help you remove the feelings of indecision and advance a deal. But I can maybe talk about that later. But the Faces of Discovery play is my favorite. And I've been teaching this to salespeople for close to 6 years now. And the ones that adopt, I'm building here. We'll get there. The ones that adopt this play have a 90%+ conversion rate from first meeting to second meeting. In other words, if you do this right, the person that you're talking to is going to lean in and is going to talk to you more and bring more people to the party over 90% of the time. I mean, it is statistically significant. It is, in my mind, one of the silver bullets for discovery. Okay, so here's the plan. Before walking into any meeting, virtual or in person, do your homework on the individual, on the business, on the persona, and the problems that those people are faced with. So for big accounts, public accounts, annual reports, reading news, reading investor briefings and presentations, listening to earnings calls. For private accounts, reading the news, looking at their LinkedIn profiles, looking at their competition, reading their website, things like that. And what you're trying to do through, and I like to think of like, this is you're trying to put a bunch of like puzzle pieces together to form a hypothesis. And the hypothesis is, hey, I'm about to meet with you. What problem do you as an individual, as a person inside your role in the business and your business as a whole, what challenges are you likely faced with right now that my solution, that whatever I'm selling, can help with? And what I do is I take that information. I start with their LinkedIn picture, and I literally put their picture on a slide, their circle, just right there. I then title the slide, what I think you care about. And then I put 3 to 4 bullets based on all this homework, my hypothesis, on the slide. Then comes the narrative around it. The narrative around it is very simple. It's and you execute this, if you're a fan of the ASEM framework, appreciate time, confirm time, set end game agenda, mutual agenda, and then you go into a level of, hey, before we get started, before, you know, I show you how we can help, is it okay if I ask, you know, a few questions and, you know, for us to kind of chat a little bit? Right there, you pull up that slide and you say, hey, look, I like to make sure that, again, fear of mortality here, Andy, there's a lot of common themes here. I like to make sure our time is well spent, and I always do my homework on the individual to make sure that we are here to have a productive conversation for you. So I did my homework and I pull up the slide and I said, I put this together for this conversation as an outsider looking in, and this is key. I'm probably wrong. People love to correct you. I'm probably wrong. As an outsider looking in, I am probably wrong. But what I saw is, and I read the slide, A, yeah. B, C bullets. I'd love to have a conversation about this and for you to tell me maybe where I'm right, where I'm wrong, and where maybe I've missed the mark. And I'd love to go a little deeper with you. Is that okay?
Love that.
And then I shut up.
Yeah.
And they read the slide. They see their picture. And they say, that's me on a slide. And I'm like, yeah. And then they're like, no. You got these right, but you got this way wrong. Let me tell you more about that. And they just spill. And I just sit there, frantically take notes.
Yeah. I love that. And everyone knows what's happening here, but just to call it out, for me, the biggest part of this is there's many components. For me, the biggest part of this is you have hyper-accelerated your route to credibility with that prospect, because you've done a number of things. You've shown that you value their time because they've seen that you've invested time ahead of the meeting for them, solely for them. And like in your talk track, it supported that as well. And so you've done that. You've also shown that even if incorrect, you have a relevant perspective, because it's like, imagine if one of those bullet points is wrong, it's unlikely to be wildly wrong. You know, it's going to be like, you know, it might be that, you know, one of your major issues right now is like their electronics company, you might have a major issue with supply chain from, you know, chips from Asia or something like that. And they might be like, actually, no, we actually get our chips from somewhere else. Right. But, you know, the fact that you know that they might have that problem has actually caused a, wow, this person knows what they're talking about, but it'd be also a chance for you to go, oh, okay, so that's actually no longer a problem. So it's just excellent. It's excellent. And I always think this, I talk about it like this. It's like, so our customers are so used to our, for salespeople just acting desperate. Like it's quite hard to get a meeting with a prospective customer. And so when we get one, we typically don't like to let it go easily. We want to try and do the best we can, even though, you know, I would say the level of preparation as a standard in their industry doesn't support that as a hypothesis. And so when we see our customers are so used to salespeople engaging, either doing a bad job or maybe doing a good job, but it's just not enough value to make it worthwhile to evaluate their solution, but they won't let it go. And therefore they chase the customer around, you know, around their inbox. You know, they would even turn up at their house if they knew where they lived. And it just tells the customer, wow, this person must be desperate. But for you to put the time in up front, it says to the customer, wow, this person must genuinely believe they have value to offer me, because why else would they have invested their precious time otherwise? Yeah. So, yeah, I love
that. It shows you came to play the game. There's an ego stroke with the picture. The picture is key. Like people get a little weirded out by the picture. Like the sellers get weirded out by that. Mm-hmm. I've never had a customer get weirded out by that. Not once. Every customer I've ever done this to has said, or a prospect, whatever, has said, oh my God, it's me on a slide. Oh my God, where'd you get that? Oh my God, that's really cool. I've never seen anyone do this before.
Yeah.
It's always a, oh my God, something. Like, yeah. Yeah. And by the way, psychologically speaking, people like looking at themselves.
Yeah.
So like you're immediately creating affinity for the conversation. To your point, huge trust acceleration by the hypothesis. The I'm probably wrong is key, because what you're doing is removing all ego and you're inviting correction, and people love to correct you. So therefore they will now lean in. And ultimately, what I'm trying to do with this is this concept of earning the right. If you just show up and say, hey, what are your challenges? I'm not telling you yet. I don't trust you.
Yeah.
But you earn the right to do it through this level of prep. And oh my God, you have now they are going to give you the real real, and they're willing to give you a second layer than they normally would.
Yes.
That then, to your point, accelerates this deal forward. This to me is a cheat code. Like, you do this, holy crap. And by the way, people would be like, oh, that takes so much time. I've boiled this down to like 5-10 minutes. Oh. If you can't take 10 minutes before a meeting, like, get out of sales.
Yeah,
like,
seriously. You're not in the wrong. Yeah, I 100% agree. 100% agree. I'll give you one quick anecdote along the same lines as that kind of I'm probably wrong bit. One of our tactics we love to get our folks to do, and I, you know, something I always got my teams to as a sales leader is to play back the decision criteria to the customer once you've kind of started to establish it, even from a first meeting. So you'd say, sounds to me, you know, and this is one of the beautiful things about MedPIC is people have their own voice. So they don't have to say it the same way I would, but this is kind of a clinical way of saying it. Dear Mr. Customer, it's great to meet you, blah, 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 blah. Sounds to me like in this solution, you're looking for these things, or these things are important to you. And then, of course, the beautiful thing to do is to lace in some of your own strengths in there. So either, like, you know, you'd say something along the lines of, it sounds like this wasn't something you'd previously considered as being important, but from our conversation, it seems like this is something that will be important for you achieving the goals you want, whatever it is. And I've loved to do that. And it's the hyper professional move here is to get your, if it's a technical decision criteria part, to get the sales engineer solution consultant to do that. So you introduce them as a point of contact into your deal as well. And then you can handle like the economical and the relationship side of the decision criteria as well yourself. So it kind of splits those two out. But I had a guy on my team once, and this is not a tactic that I would do. And this is one of the things I love about sales is because people have different sort of flavors and styles and things. But to your point about I'm probably wrong, he used to do this, and he'd put something wildly incorrect in. Not necessarily that wild, but something that was just completely out of thin air in as one of these bullet points, whether it was to do with a pain, whether it was to do with the decision criteria, whether it was to do with anything. Because he wanted to check a couple of things. He wanted to check if the customer was actually reading it, and then they're
paying attention,
and or if they are, would they call him out? Did they care enough to go, you know what, Jim, in this case, you've got that wrong, and here's actually everything's right except for that. It forced them to confirm everything else as well. So I've always that's not something I would do, because I personally, and this is one of the beautiful things about sales, why everyone shouldn't be the same like robots. I feel like I credit more not coming across as having something wrong. Like I feel like with my customers, I don't want them to think that I misheard them or like made something up. But to some people, that like for this guy, that was a win for him.
There's a he has zero need to be liked, zero need to be right. I dig that. I love the confidence in that. There's a psychology, and there's a little almost bit of mental manipulation there that goes maybe a little indexing far, but I really love that. Like there's just something about that the forcing of correction, the forcing of deeper conversation, the forcing of paying attention. Again, that's someone that has came to the party to play and is one or two steps ahead of the other people. Yeah. And I like to think of things like a game of chess. Like that's someone who's like, yeah, I'm two moves ahead of you right now. And I dig that. I love that. That's awesome. Cool.
Okay, David, last question. It's a quick fire one. What is not your most important, but what is your favorite element of MedPIC? Which letter is your favorite?
Ooh. It's got to be metrics, man. I am a big business case guy. I think with Archimedes, with the right lever, I can move the world. With the right business case, I can make anything happen. So, you know, to me, that's it. Economic buyer would probably be a very, 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 very close second. But yeah.
I love that. David? It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
Oh, yeah. Hit me up on LinkedIn. David Weiss at the Sales Collective. David Weiss Deal Doc. Just look, I get out of bed every single day to help the sales community sell better. So if I can ever do anything for you, just like literally I'm here for you. So Andy, seriously, bro, I love our conversations. Every time we talk, it just makes the rest of my day better. So
yeah, likewise, I appreciate that. Thank you, dude.